Hello all, it's Mitchell Warren from AVAC here, and delighted to welcome you to this updated call on very recent information about oral pre-exposure prophylaxis. As you can hear from a number of the beeps in the background, there are a number of people still joining, so we are going to give it just another couple of minutes before we jump off. If you are not able to see slides have the web link, hopefully, in your email from ReadyTalk, you can log in and see. If you do have any trouble, go ahead and email avac@avac.org, and we will do our utmost to sort it out. And you'll be able to see slides that John Smith is going to present in just a couple of minutes. So, as I say, we'll get started shortly. All right. Well, given the lull in beeps, I will assume it's time to start. Good morning and good afternoon for those further away. I am Mitchell Warren, the director of AVAC, and delighted to welcome you to this special webinar on the recently released guidelines related to oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, in the United States. I think most of you on the line have followed an evolving story over the last many years, now almost a decade since the first large-scale human clinical trials began to enroll around the idea of oral pre-exposure prophylaxis. And over that decade, we have seen a cascade of data from a range of clinical trials. We have seen in the United States 2 years ago the approval by the U.S. regulator, the Food and Drug Administration, approving the combination drug tenofovir and emtricitabine for use as PrEP. And just last week, very excitingly, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention here in the United States released public health service guidelines related to the use of PrEP in the United States. I know there are a lot of acronyms there, but happily our presenter today is going to outline and help us all understand some of the mysteries behind all that has unfolded of late. And it really is with enormous pleasure that we're able to invite Dawn Smith from the CDC to provide this update today. Dawn is at the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention, and anyone working in PrEP is aware of Dawn's leadership in this field, both in terms of the support and engagement in the actual clinical trials that have taken place over that past decade, as well as really shepherding through interim guidance that was released by the CDC with each passing clinical trial in different populations, and very happily really led the effort to develop these comprehensive guidelines, which were launched last week. We are in a muted mode so that we can record the call, but we'll be posting this later. We do certainly encourage questions. Dawn's going to present for the next little while, and then open it up to Q&A. If you have questions as she presents, feel free to put them in the chat feature in the web interface. You can email at avac@avac.org at any point. And I'll also open the line, hopefully, with time for people to ask questions live on the phone. So that's the kind of format for the call, and we really look forward to that conversation. So without further ado, it is my great pleasure to introduce John Smith and to turn it over to Dawn to present the Public Health Service guidelines.
Hi, everybody. I want to start by returning the compliment. When we decided that we wanted to find a way to reach out to as many advocates and community members as possible, we knew that we had to turn to AVAC and Mitch Warren to do that for us. He also has been with this adventure since the early days and is a key part of getting us to the point where we are at the moment. So let's talk a little bit about the guidelines. Can I move the slides, or are you moving the slides for me?
Actually, John, I think it's, we can move them for you.
Okay, fine. Okay, so I want to start off just with a little context about how far we have come in the PrEP field and give you some sense of how it fits in the whole spectrum of other biomedical and clinical interventions. So there was a very often cited study that was done in 2000 about how long it takes to get from original research to full implementation where a new medical intervention is standard of care. And they concluded that on average it takes 17 years to turn 14% of original research to the benefit of patient care. The first year of that is getting from the research to publication. And in PrEP, we did that, and we did it in about the time frame. It took about a year from the time that study results were analyzed until they were published and widely available. The next block is getting from publication of the landmark trial results to systematic reviews and guidelines. And there we did a really good job, and we'll talk a little bit about how that happened. But on average, that takes somewhere from 6 to 13 years. We managed to do it in a couple of years. And then when you get from reviews and guidelines to standard of clinical practice, that takes, on average, 9 or more years. I think we can do better than that, but it gives us an idea of the difficulty in translating science into actual real community-level impact. Next slide. I'm not going to talk a lot about the trial results because most of you have been through them all a lot. There are several webinars and other materials on the AVAC website if you're interested in going back and looking at each trial. And there's also a webinar from the CDC this afternoon called Public Health Grand Round that will be at 1 p.m. and there will be an extensive review of the trials in that presentation. But this is a nice summary slide, which basically shows that for all of the trials in all of the populations, you can see a black line going across there that says zero. Anything above that showed effectiveness. Anything below that didn't show effectiveness. And going from left to right, it's the proportion of participants in the trial that had tenofovir detectable in their blood. And so what you can see is that all of the trials that showed effectiveness, IPREX, TDF2, Partners PrEP, all of them are towards the right half. So more patients had drug in their blood than not drug in their blood, and the result was higher levels of efficacy. On the left, you see the trials that showed no efficacy, FemPrep and the two voice arms. And again, you see that there was very low levels of blood detected, and that was associated with not being able to demonstrate efficacy. So in summary, that's what we know, that if you take the drug, it can be highly effective in preventing people from getting HIV infection. Next slide. However, even before we had trial results, we had an idea that PrEP might work. Antiretrovirals work to prevent perinatal transmission. They work to prevent, when used as post-exposure prophylaxis, they prevent needle stick injuries to healthcare workers leading to infection. So we had an idea that it might work. We knew that it was going to be a complicated issue, and we knew that it was going to require a fairly comprehensive guideline. So we started early to get a lot of input from a variety of kinds of stakeholders and experts. And this gives you a sample of, we had standing work groups in several areas that met by teleconference for several months to go through different issues in their particular arena. And then when we had specific issues that needed special expertise, the technical expert meetings. There were other times when it was necessary to convene sort of special calls to deal with a special population, and we did that, for example, with transgender. We had a call that just talked about transgender issues for PrEP. Next slide. So at the end of the day, after a lot of work, a lot of input, we put some of the recommendations up for public comment, a lot of review by peers that were sent copies to provide review to, we finally published the guidelines last week. There are two documents. One is the clinical practice guideline, and the other is the clinical provider supplement. The first point to make is that these documents are intended for clinicians prescribing PrEP. They are not trying to address the issues for all the populations that may be involved with PrEP. So these are specifically targeting the clinicians. In the guideline itself, there's a review of all of the efficacy and safety evidence, and then there's guidance on identifying patients, which ones have indications that PrEP might be of benefit to them, which ones have contraindications suggesting that PrEP should not be used with them. And then there's guidance on how to prescribe it, what laboratory testing to do, how to handle follow-up care. There's a strong emphasis on supporting medication adherence and risk reduction counseling, and there's guidance on reporting HIV infection and PrEP use in pregnancy using standard mechanisms that are already in place. Next slide. Then in the clinical provider supplement, we have things that we think of as tools or further information for providers. So, for example, we have a patient-provider checklist to help patients and providers anticipate what should be going on in terms of screening for PrEP, in terms of counseling for PrEP, in terms of follow-up for PrEP. There's a special information sheet for providers who are counseling about PrEP during conception, pregnancy, and breastfeeding. One of the recommendations in the guideline is that providers should go through the risks and benefits, what's known and what's not known in this context. And we realize that many primary care providers won't have been following that literature. So we developed an information sheet to help the clinicians come up to speed in that area. There's a brief screening tool for gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men, which has previously been published. There's some supplemental counseling information. There's some information about how you might bill for PrEP-related services. And for clinicians who want to look at practice quality measures in their clinics, we've had some to suggest. There are information sheets that can be given to patients. Those are available in English in the supplement. And on the CDC website, they're available in both English and in Spanish. Next slide. So the key messages for the guidelines are that daily oral PrEP with Truvada is recommended as a prevention option for persons who are at substantial risk of HIV infection, including sexually active MSM, heterosexually active men and women, injection drug users. The recommendation is that PrEP should be discussed with HIV discordant couples for use during conception and pregnancy. As I said before, weighing the risks and the benefits, what's known and what's not known, because there were no trials done specifically looking at this issue. However, there were people in the trials that included women who became pregnant, and so we have some data about the safety in very early pregnancy, and there are many studies that have been done with HIV-positive women who are being treated with Truvada as part of their treatment regimen, who become pregnant and maintain their treatment throughout pregnancy, and there's been no evidence of any untoward effects either to moms or to the pregnancy or to the children. We recommend that daily oral PrEP with Truvada should be considered for adolescents, but needs to be weighed carefully because there are local laws and guidelines about what services a minor can consent to without parental consent. And often that does not include preventive medical care. And so providers need to know what the rules and regulations are in their area. In addition, there were no safety data for adolescents because none of the studies included people under age 18. The Adolescent Trials Network is now doing some studies with adolescents, and so in a year or so, we should have some safety data for adolescents. However, Truvada is also used in the treatment regimen of adolescents with HIV infection, and we are not aware of any safety issues in those adolescents. The other key message is that clinicians who are prescribing PrEP should support medication adherence actively and should support patients to either adopt or continue risk reduction practices to reduce their exposures to HIV. Next slide. So what do we say about how clinicians should assess for indications of PrEP for PrEP use? Among all sexually active adults, both men who have sex with men and heterosexual men and women, we suggest that PrEP should be considered if the person is HIV negative and known to have a positive sexual partner, if there is recent bacterial STIs, high numbers of sex partners, history of inconsistent or no condom use, or if the patient has reports being engaged in commercial sex work. Next slide. Specifically for heterosexuals, because there are so many heterosexuals in the United States, some are at high risk, some are not at high risk, we also suggest that people consider the local prevalence. And we provide some tools for clinicians to do that. The reason for that is that if you're a heterosexually active person, and let's say that you have two or three sex partners in a year and you report inconsistent condom use, which is not uncommon, if we just use those criteria, then, you know, we'd be talking about 30, 40 million people that we would be putting on PrEP. And we probably would not prevent that many HIV infections. However, if those people engaging in those behaviors are in a zip code or community that has a very high HIV prevalence, then every time they choose a new sexual partner, they stand a good risk that one of them may be HIV infected and may not even be aware of it. So we ask providers to consider prevalence specifically for heterosexual men and women. Next slide. For injection drug users, if they have an HIV-positive injecting partner, if they share any injection equipment, and if they have recently been in drug treatment but are currently injecting. One of the interesting things about drug treatment for injection drugs is that there's a fairly high rate of relapse. And so someone who's recently been in drug treatment, you would think, well, they may not have a risk behavior. But in fact, if they've been in and out of drug treatment and are currently injecting, that is a factor associated with HIV infection. Next slide. Then we advise clinicians about which patients are not appropriate, or how to determine which patients shouldn't be prescribed PrEP. And most of those are clinical indications. So providers must document a negative HIV test result just before prescribing PrEP. PrEP is not adequate treatment for HIV infection and should not be given to any person who has HIV infection already. We need to know that there are no signs and symptoms of acute HIV infection. These are patients who may have a negative antibody test but have a history of a recent exposure or history of a viral-like illness, in which you have to look not just for the antibodies but for the evidence of the virus itself. And the reason this is important is because in the trials, resistance was a problem only in patients who were started on PrEP when they were in acute HIV infection. And so we don't want to replicate that in the community setting. We want to know that people have normal renal function. If they have very low renal function, they should not receive PrEP. And there are certain medications that are associated with damage to the kidneys. And those provider should either not prescribe Truvada or change the other medication, but should not prescribe them together. We want to know whether the person has active hepatitis B. Now, that's not a contraindication to PrEP, but what it means is that if they have no evidence of vaccination, they should be vaccinated. If they have chronic active hepatitis B infection, you need to know that when you put them on PrEP, because the drug that's used for PrEP is also used to treat hepatitis B infection. And when a year later or 18 months later the person wants to come off PrEP, you need to know that they had an active hepatitis B so you can monitor their liver functions and intervene if there's any rebound viral activity that could be damaging their liver. So if there are no contraindications, then we say please prescribe PrEP as daily continuing oral doses of Truvada and to give a 90-day supply or less. The 90-day supply is important because we want people to come back for regular HIV testing. Next slide. We talked a little bit about screening for acute HIV infection. This is an abbreviated presentation of a longer flowchart that gives clinicians specific advice about what questions to ask about acute HIV infection and what tests to do to rule out acute HIV infection. Next slide. Okay, so once you start a patient on PrEP, we ask clinicians for all patients to do follow-up visits every 3 months, and at those visits to do an HIV test to confirm that they're still HIV negative, to assess how they're doing with taking their medications daily, and provide any counseling or support that's necessary if they're having trouble doing that, assess whether their risk behavior is changing, and if appropriate, give them additional behavioral risk reduction support. Find out what side effects they're having and help them to manage the side effects. And ask about symptoms of sexually transmitted infection. At any point that a person has symptoms of an STI, they should be tested and treated. At 3 months, and then every 6 months thereafter, we want to recheck the renal function to be sure that nothing is happening in response to the Truvada. And every 6 months, regardless of symptoms, patients should be tested for bacterial sexually transmitted infections. This is because you're giving PrEP to someone because they are at high risk for HIV infection. And the same behaviors that put them at risk for HIV put them at risk for STIs. Many bacterial STIs are symptomatic, specifically in men, and therefore it's important to do the testing every 6 months, irrespective of symptoms. Next slide. For MSM specifically, we want to be sure that the STI testing includes testing of oral and rectal specimens. Next slide. For women, we want to be sure that we know whether they're trying to get pregnant or want to get pregnant in the next little while so that you can discuss whether PrEP would be appropriate during pregnancy. And for all women, we want to do a pregnancy test every 3 months so that if they have an unplanned pregnancy even, you can have the conversation about what they want to do in terms of their PrEP use. Next slide. For injection drug users, we want them to have access to clean needles, syringes, and drug treatment services. Different communities will have different levels of different methods for providing that access, and we ask providers to know what's available and legal in their jurisdiction so that they can provide those services to injection drug users. Next. We talked a little bit about the supplement and the fact sheets and the things that are present in that. Next sheet. One of the things that has happened sort of then is trying to figure out how to take the guidelines and make them easily implementable for the clinicians. And so now we're moving a little bit into the implementation phase, that 9-plus-year phase where you go from a guideline to actual clinical practice. Many studies have shown that providers don't routinely ask about HIV risk behaviors. And this is a problem when you have an intervention where you have to ask about that in order to determine whether people are eligible or not eligible for PrEP. Next slide. And so CDC has been working on some brief risk screening tools that clinicians can use so that you have a systematic and, but more importantly, a brief way for clinicians to ask the questions that are necessary to see whether someone is at sufficient risk that PrEP would make sense. So we're developing a suite of tools called the Assessing Risk for Contracting HIV, or ARCH tools. There's one for MSM that's already been published. There's another one for injection drug users that is about to be submitted for publication. And there's one for HIV discordant couples, the data for which has recently been published, but the application that would be used is still in development. We also know that we need to help with the demand side of PrEP, and so we have a pamphlet called How to Talk to Your Doctor About PrEP, so that patients who hear about it and want to go into their clinicians would have something that they can hold on to provide them some guidance about how to talk about it. There are also some resources for providers on the back of the pamphlet for those providers maybe who aren't up to speed on it. And then for clinicians, we're also developing a guide for using billing codes. Obviously, for busy clinical practices, they want to be able to get reimbursed for the services that they provide around PrEP. Next slide. One of the issues that has been on everyone's mind since the earliest days is how are we gonna manage the cost of an antiretroviral medication. What has happened in the last couple of years is that many people in the communities have sort of stepped up to make this much less of an issue. So PrEP is now covered by most private employers, school-based, and public insurers. And there is a medication copay assistance program available for people who have insurance but for whom the copay may be difficult. For those who have low income and no insurance coverage, Gilead Sciences has a medication assistance program that will provide free drug to the provider for that patient. They also have a program that will provide free condoms and HIV testing, free hepatitis B screening, and HIV resistance testing if someone seroconverts while they're on PrEP. Similarly, the Washington State has recently set up its own PrEP drug assistance program. So we're happy to know that even though the medication remains expensive, that for many patients, if not most patients, there are ways to help with the cost of obtaining PrEP. Next slide. So throughout the guidelines, wherever we identify something that would be useful to clinicians in prescribing, we try to provide links for providers. So, for example, the Medication Assistance Program, the National Association of State and Territorial AIDS Directors has prepared a nice flyer that has specific instructions and phone numbers for how to reach medication assistance programs, not just for PrEP, but also for non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis. Next slide. One of the things as we move from guidelines to actual clinical practice that has been driven home to us is that unlike the treatment cascade where you're really focused on individuals with HIV infection, in this case there are two important arms to the cascade. One is the patients, but the other is the providers. If we have a lot of patients who need PrEP and who want PrEP and we don't have providers who are ready and willing and educated to provide it, then we can't really move forward with implementation. So we're trying to work at each step in this cascade to try to make sure that we can make the best use of PrEP in the next few years. Next slide. When we think about introducing a new anything, one of the things that there's been a lot of research on what predicts which things get adopted and how fast they get adopted. This is an example where they were looking at the adoption of various technologies. Note that the time frame runs from 1900 to 2005. So if you look at the solid red line, for example, which is automobiles, you can see that in the first 15 years, there was very little uptake. Then there was very rapid uptake, and then it stabilized. And then it went up some more until now we're at a point where really 90% of people have a car. In more recent years, even if you look at something like the Internet, which is the line on the furthest most part, you're talking about 15 years until you get to 60% uptake. And cell phones went a little faster, but still, they started in the late 1980s and they got up, you know, above 90% only in the 2000s, so it took about 20 years. So when people say, well, you know, the FDA already made its decision 2 years ago, how come we have so little uptake? It's important to understand that these things take time, but that, you know, we're obviously not going to be talking probably about a 100-year path. We're going to be talking about, 5, 10, or 15 years maybe to get to where we need to be for PrEP to have its most important impact. Next slide. Another way to look at it is some of the new clinical practices. Again, if you look at the flu vaccine, after 32 years, only 55% of those who were supposed to be getting a flu vaccine were getting it. And similarly for mammograms, after 18 years we were doing better, about 70% were getting, who were indicated were getting their annual mammograms. Next slide. So let's look a little bit about what we know about PrEP. So at CDC, we've been putting questions about PrEP onto a national survey of primary care clinicians. And if you look at the proportion on the left who've ever heard of PrEP before the survey, we're up to almost 50% in 2013. In 2009 and 2010, far fewer had even heard of it in the first place. The other thing to notice is that when we ask them who they think PrEP should be provided for in 2013, you can see that for most of the risk groups that we asked about, 50% or more of providers said, yes, you should definitely consider providing PrEP to them. So we have a fair amount of willingness in the community among primary care clinicians. They are important because HIV-negative people don't typically go to infectious disease doctors. And so we want the care clinicians to be familiar with PrEP and comfortable with using it. Next slide. The only estimate we have of early PrEP uptake comes from an analysis that Gilead Sciences did by looking at a commercial pharmacy database that includes about a little more than half of all U.S. prescriptions. And they found that PrEP was pretty widespread, actually, that there was at least one prescriber in 700 cities and 49 states. I believe Wyoming was the outlier. And that the largest group were family practitioners and general internists. And then infectious disease docs were doing it, but at a less frequency. In 2011, they thought they detected 150 prescriptions. By 2012, there were 1,274 prescriptions. That's an 8.5-fold rise in a single year. So I think we're definitely moving forward, even though the numbers themselves are reasonably small. These numbers also don't include the estimated 2,000 or so people who are getting PrEP as part of demonstration projects or open label studies. Next slide. Here's where we'd like to be. So I want to give you a good example of why in HIV in particular, people expect fairly rapid uptake. And we've been a little bit spoiled because we've seen it in a number of instances. So in 1994, we issued the first guidelines for the use of zidovudine in pregnancy for perinatal prevention. The year before those guidelines were listed are in blue, and the 2 years after is listed in red. And what you can see is that there was a fair amount of testing in labor that was going on before the guidelines came out, before we had something specific to do to help a positive pregnant woman. But it went up even further. And if you follow that over time, it's probably stayed about that level. But then if you look at how many women who were pregnant and positive were offered zidovudine, you can see that within 2 years, we went from about 25% up to 85%. Next slide. And as a result of that, the estimated number of perinatally acquired AIDS cases began to drop dramatically, so that we went from nearly 1,000 at the time to less than 100 in recent years. So this kind of demonstration of rapid uptake often makes people in the HIV field feel that things should be almost instantaneous. But there are some important differences to know about perinatal and PrEP. In the case of perinatal prophylaxis, you have a population of people who are already in medical care, and you have no disagreement at all about who is eligible, who needs this intervention. If you're tested, you're positive, you're pregnant, you need the intervention. The parents want the intervention because they don't want to have an HIV-positive child. The doctors want the intervention because they want to make sure that every chance was given that the child would remain uninfected. And so, you know, it's all insured. Prenatal care is insured. So there was a lot of excitement around the initial announcement. This was the first time we had seen that we could use retrovirals in this way. There was a lot of funding. There was a lot of training. There was a lot of support for its implementation. So this is what you can have. Now, with PrEP, we're in a very different situation. Most of the people who need PrEP are not coming into routine care around their HIV risk behavior. Many of the providers don't ask the right questions, as we saw before, and don't know what to do with the answers when they get them. They don't also know necessarily about PrEP. There were these issues about resistance. So it's likely that this is not going to be the same kind of rapid uptake that we saw with perinatal prophylaxis. But we hope that it will be a much shorter course than the 9 or 10 years that the initial slide would suggest. Next slide. So what we need to do in order to make sure that this occurs in a timely fashion is to take what we already know now about PrEP, to increase awareness and linkage to clinical care for the people who will benefit from PrEP use most, who are at the highest risk of getting HIV infected in the near future. we need to increase the awareness and training for providers who are interested in offering PrEP to their patients. And we need to increase our ability to see how we're doing, to systematically monitor PrEP use and its impact on health. You know, people say nothing succeeds like success. If we can show fairly soon that where PrEP uptake was the greatest, there were reductions in HIV incidence, people will want to replicate that. We then also need to keep learning more, and so we'll be learning soon some of the things from the open label studies and the demonstration projects that will help us to modify our practices. We need to continue implementation research to understand which sites are best suited to provide PrEP to which populations, how to make it, how to streamline it without losing efficacy. And then we obviously need to continue clinical research. There's lots of research about whether there are other drugs we can use for PrEP, whether there are new forms of drugs like injectables that will help with the adherence problem, and whether there are other prevention tools like microbicides that will be shown to be effective. So that's my discussion of guidelines and how we're going to use them to implement. I'd love to hear your questions.
Fantastic. Dawn, thank you so very, very much for a really thorough, comprehensive review. There are a lot of questions that have already been queued up. I will remind people we're in muted mode, but you can ask questions live by hitting *7 to unmute your line. I would ask you to hit *6 to go back. You can keep going into the chat function or emailing at avac@avac.org. And as I said, a number of questions already came in. And perhaps, Dawn, let me just start by a huge cluster of them relate to how the CDC and others plan to use these new guidelines, and particularly in terms of providers, how to communicate to primary care providers, how to train, and wondering what, if anything, the CDC has specifically planned to both disseminate and then make use of these guidelines at the provider level.
We have a lot of things in the planning process, and I think they fall into two huge buckets. One bucket are things that we can do with our current resources, and so we're working with our clinical partners through our prevention communications branch to place articles about PrEP in journals that primary care providers read, to develop slide sets for them to use, to work with our prevention training centers to develop CME modules, to make sure that we do presentations or sessions at conferences, to go through the guidelines. So there are a number of plans that we have for disseminating the guidelines themselves. So, for example, the National Medical Association had already asked us what was all this about PrEP, and so we went and we had a conversation with their leadership about PrEP. We didn't yet have the guidelines. We're now working with their HIV point person to be sure that there's a presentation on the guidelines at their national conference this year. So that's one of many things that we can do with our own resources. Things like developing brochures and fact sheets. Now, many other organizations are doing that, too. AVAC has lots of useful materials on their website. Project Inform has materials on their website. I think some of the open label projects and demonstration projects are going to begin producing materials. So with our own internal resources, we can do. We also have a long list of things that we can do if we get additional funding. And because of the way our budget system works, we don't know yet how much funding we're going to have in the next year, but we're already queuing up things that we could do to help support PrEP with additional funding.
Great. Thanks for that, John. And I'm assuming if people have either suggestions or want to know more or work with you directly, you are an open line. Is that correct?
Absolutely. But I think it's also true that our partners are going to be really important. I mean, it's just like, you know, if you think about HIV treatment, for example, HRSA, because of its Ryan White role, does a lot in this area, including with the AETCs. But they are by no means the only people who do training and support and development of new materials and methods. And so I think, you know, the American Academy of HIV Medicine, the American Academy of Family Practice, I mean, for the provider side of things, we have a lot of key partners. For the program side of things, again, I can't remember the initials, but every state has an STD director. Every state has an HIV director. Every state has a substance abuse director. Their organizations are already very interested in PrEP, and how are we going to fold PrEP into those programs at the state level? So those people are partners. All the many community-based organizations who are out there already working with these populations are also, you know, critical to this. What are they going to do? What information are they going to incorporate into their public materials? So, yes, please do call CDC, but expect that we're going to also turn a lot of that around to our partners because we can't possibly do it all ourselves.
Great. Understood. Let me also then turn, there are a series of questions about different kind of population-specific issues, and maybe you can address some of these. So I'll just tick them off and come back to a number of them. One, a question about the ARCH tool, which you described, and you presented three different elements of the ARCH tool for different populations, but a great question here that you didn't mention one specifically for women. You certainly mentioned one for people in service court and relationships. So the question was, with many women not knowing the status of their partner, not knowing if they're in a serious discordant relationship, could an ARCH tool be developed for women more generally?
We're trying to do that. The problem that we have with women in the U.S. is that the way that we develop these brief risk screening tools is to actually look at studies that had HIV incidence as an outcome, and that measured behavior and incidence at frequent intervals. And then we could ask a question statistically, what behaviors at time one best predict who became infected at time two? And use that to develop a very brief, five, six, seven question screening tool. The problem for women in the U.S. is that we don't have any large studies that had HIV incidence as an outcome. So what we're doing is we're working with our STD colleagues to try to develop one that has either an HIV or STD as an outcome. And so we hope to be able to add a component that's for heterosexual women and men.
Great. Thanks. Related, this one back to the issue of couples, actually, not specifically to couples, but reading a bunch of them here. But one of them related to women's health providers. And a question, you mentioned a bunch of organizations, but you didn't mention the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And a question from someone who said, given that so many women, you know, get their sexual health needs met at the OBGYN, is there specific outreach the CDC plans with that cadre of health professionals?
Yes. The handout that we prepared for physicians dealing with pregnant women and PrEP was done with outreach to members of the ACOG. And ACOG recently issued its statement, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology issued its own statement in support of PrEP. And the perinatal guidelines, as a result, have a very strong statement that PrEP can be considered in pregnancy and breastfeeding. So there's that part. We've also been working with our colleagues at the Office of Population Affairs, who run all the Title X family planning clinics in the United States, and they are also very interested in figuring out how to incorporate PrEP into their family planning settings, especially in communities with high incidence, where they've already instituted HIV testing programs.
Great. Thanks for that. Donna, another population-specific question, and actually a number of questions coming in both on this call and actually prior to the call, just after the guidelines were issued, and it really relates to the transgender population. There was a small subset of trial participants in IPREX, as you well know, who identified as transgender, there's not a lot of clarity in your presentation here, as a number of people noted, or in the guidelines themselves about transgender individuals. And wonder how that fits in and how that should be addressed.
Yeah. When we write guidelines, clinical practice guidelines, we have to write them in a way that every recommendation we give can be linked back to a piece of evidence. And in the case of transgender, we simply don't have the evidence. In IPREX, for example, there were 2,499 participants, of whom 29 were transgender. 29 people is not enough to assess either efficacy or safety. So we did not exclude transgender from our recommendations, but we didn't make a specific recommendation about transgender because there isn't the data available to support a recommendation one way or the other. So I think for those who are involved in anal intercourse, then I would think that the MSM guideline would apply to them. For all persons who are involved in vaginal intercourse, penile vaginal intercourse, I would think the heterosexual guidelines would apply to them. So I think what we hope is that people, based on their behavior, can find a guideline that applies to them, without us having to try to say something that we don't have the evidence to say.
Okay. Thanks for that. There are a bunch more questions. I think, I realize we're getting toward the top of the hour. Perhaps I'll pause there to see if anyone would like to ask additional questions from the line. Again, *7 to unmute your line. I would ask that it be brief, introduce yourself, and then go back on mute by hitting *6. Any questions from the line? We have more here. So we'll keep going. If you do, just hit *7 again and let me know that you have questions. Don, a number of questions which I realize are likely outside of your purview. I know they're outside of your purview, but I think it would be terrific to get your insights on this. And that is, these guidelines are very clearly for the United States, developed by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But you've also been involved in a number of international conversations, and a number of questions came in, how you think these guidelines might influence the international conversation. How could they or should they? And if you have any sense of what that might look like.
Well, I think there's a couple things to say. One is that, as you know, all of the trials involved international populations. And in fact, there were very few U.S. participants in the MSM trial, which was the only one that had any U.S. participants. So since the guidelines are based on results from these international trials, I would say that that aspect of the guidelines, the safety and the efficacy part, applies as much internationally as it applies in the U.S., if not more so. I think when you start talking about who's going to provide it and what it costs and what kinds of testing to do, a lot of that is very specific. There are things that are approved in the U.S. that are not available overseas, and vice versa. There are things that are approved overseas that aren't available in the U.S. with respect to different kinds of HIV testing, for example, or syphilis testing. So I think the practicalities about what you ask clinicians to do with the guidelines are really very much country-specific. I would say that WHO, which has responsibility for PrEP guidelines is already starting a process to write their own guidelines around this. And I would say that similarly, I think OGAC, the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, is considering what this means for PEPFAR programs focused on prevention. So I think those are probably the two places where the guidelines may help to inform some international activities. Does that help?
That's very helpful, and it's clearly, and it won't surprise, no one surprise you and probably anyone on the call, it's certainly a priority advocacy issue for global advocates to ensure that this doesn't just become a United States guideline and that it does translate elsewhere. So no, that's an incredibly helpful answer. So someone also raised a question related to that, I think, is the issue of demonstration projects and implementation activities. And you did mention kind of you at CDC had created a list of what things you would like to do if you did have funding. At the same time, as I recall the statement last week that accompanied the guidelines, there was the discussion of the implementation project that the CDC has been designing in a number of cities in the United States. And just wondered, someone asked if you could give some any update on that particular project here in the U.S. that CDC was planning.
Yes. The sites are nearly ready to start. I would say in the next couple of months we'll definitely start. We haven't got the start date yet. But that's definitely going to happen, and that's a study that we're doing with funding that's provided to the CDC Foundation that they then granted to four community health centers in high prevalence communities, where PrEP will be provided to all persons who have indications, and we'll try to understand how it's used and what the impact is, and to what extent. And how it affects the operating budgets of the clinics.
Great. Thanks. And now two hopefully relatively quick questions. You talked about the lack of data, obviously related to adolescents. Is there a minimum age in the recommendations related to potential PrEP use?
No, we use the same language that the FDA used, which is just adults. And doesn't define it. So if you look at the package insert for Truvada for PrEP, it just says adults, and then it doesn't say more than that. I think there are adolescents who are emancipated minors who have one set of legal issues about consenting for their own treatment, and then you have adolescents who are living at home or who are still legally minors. Another issue. So I think we didn't feel like we could say, above this age, below that age kind of thing. In terms of the trials, all patients were 18 and above. So
Great. Okay. Until
we get the data from ATN, we don't really have PrEP-specific safety data for persons younger than 18.
Very helpful. And someone else asked on the other end of things, is there a point, not how old can you be, but rather, is there a point at which there are any recommendations related to when someone might be recommended to discontinue use? Is there, we often hear people talk about PrEP being for seasons. Is there any evidence and anything in the guidelines about how long the maximum season might be or should be?
No, there's not a maximum season. I think what we have is that clearly if a person becomes infected, they should come off it.
Mm.
Clearly if a person has a serious toxicity, they should come off it. And clearly if a person's risk behavior is now such that they're no longer at high risk for HIV infection, then they should think about coming off it. So we do tell providers that they should periodically assess whether to continue PrEP.
Great. One other thing a question came up, actually, which I had not heard, but, one often hears new experiences happening with insurance companies, but a question came in from someone who monitors this remarkably closely, of reports recently of people's life insurance, not the actual payment around health insurance, but life insurance was being questioned if someone was on PrEP. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, that comes not surprisingly from my prep experience blog, which is one of the greatest sources of information, and we will follow up on that. One other really quick one. You know, you talked about use data or prescribing data, some of which came from Gilead. Is it something that certainly Gilead undoubtedly continue to track that, but is the CDC planning to help track, and how might you track the diffusion of innovation in terms of numbers? Is there something in particular that you all will do in terms of trying to track PrEP users in numbers?
Yes. We have access to a number of large databases that cover both private insurers and public insurers, in which we'll be tracking, claims for PrEP to look at the same thing. We may have access to another pharmacy prescribing database that we can look at in the same way that Gilead did. And then, of course, we're adding questions to a whole variety of surveys for both high-risk populations like the National HIV Behavioral Survey and for general populations in some commercial surveys. For the general population, that's mostly around awareness and attitudes, because we don't expect that, you know, more than a very small part of the entire U.S. population is PrEP. But I think for the clinicians, again, we're thinking about some targeted surveys to particular kinds of clinicians who we think should be more prescribing PrEP more often, for example, STD clinic providers.
Great. Thank you so much. John, this has been terrific and incredibly, I think, helpful for all of us to get a sense of the guidelines. There's obviously much, much more to be done, and the conversation will continue. I do want to just say, speaking of numbers, another number to keep in mind is support for PrEP from the community at large, and I do want to call people's attention to a sign-on letter that a number of organizations got behind last week just after the guidance was put out to really show the large community support from public health organizations in the United States. When the letter was launched with about 68 organizational signers, it's now up to 116 and counting, and we're still taking signers. And if you go to prepwatch.org, you can see both the open letter and why that support is forthcoming, and if you want to sign your name either organizationally or individually, please do. In addition, on the website, you'll see a link to find out even more about PrEP. In just a couple of hours, Dawn and many colleagues at the CDC are hosting or presenting at what John described as the CDC's Public Health Grand Rounds. It is being webcast, I believe, or at least webinared, if that's a term, and that's beginning at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so just in about 2 hours, and that will be both covering, as I understand it, the science to date as well as these guidelines and what comes next. So please do sign into that. The questions, please do keep them coming. We will be in touch with Dawn to get questions back out as a follow-up, and the recording of this call will be on. As I said, in the beginning, about 4 years ago, we began to get data first from IPREX and then from the flurry of other clinical trials. 2 years ago, FDA approval, and now 1 week ago, the CDC and Public Health Service guidelines. Guidelines don't get people on PrEP. FDA approval doesn't get people on PrEP. Clinical trials don't get people on PrEP. And none of that can be delivered in public health impact without the kinds of programs and advocacy to support those programs to make them come alive, as Dawn very clearly showed in some terrific slides about innovation. And if you go back to one of her very early slides, the world has done better, at least in the United States has done better, in translating clinical trial results into public health guidance. And now it's on all of us to ensure that that public health impact comes much sooner than our history has in previous innovations. So I really want to thank Dawn and colleagues at the CDC for all the work in putting these guidelines together, and really look forward to working with everyone in civil society, in the research community, in policymaking, and in implementation to be sure that we don't let the guidelines be the end, but rather one more step of the beginning. So, John, thank you so very, very much, and we will follow up with a number of these questions that came in just as we were ending.
Thank you, Mitch, and everyone else.
Great. Cheers, all.